Hero. Mark, thanks so much for joining us here on The Morning Review. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you, Lester. Good morning, early morning hours from the state of Georgia in the United States.
And I really appreciate your time. Reflecting back over the last 20 years, of course, the shock that more than 3,000 people killed on that day, but over the last 20 years, 800,000 people have been killed on this war on terror. Reflecting back as an American citizen, but also a person who has been involved in security and global security around the world, how do you reflect on this day?
Yeah, it's a day of sadness, frankly, and of mourning. I hope that we can turn this corner. September 11th was a day that America got changed. And unfortunately for us, decisions were made based out of fear, ignorance, and arrogance. What the president did, President Bush did, is kind of lost faith. He lost his way. He lost faith in the Constitution of the United States, frankly, and developed programs that were outside the rule of law, outside of what Congress would allow. On September 14th, a national emergency was declared in the United States in the wake of the September 11th attack. But he did something rather unique, and in history, I think it will go down as a blunder. On September 17th, 2001, he issued a memorandum of notification, a secret document, a finding that enabled the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, to create what they called the RDI program, Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation Program. Rendition is disappearance, kidnapping. Detention is what we saw in this Gulag archipelago of black sites and dark prisons, and interrogation, which is nothing that they had any legitimate experience in. And so by turning away from who would traditionally have done those things, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, federal agents, at the time of the September 11th attacks, I was the commander of the USS Cole Task Force for NCIS, jointly with the FBI investigating the attack on USS Cole in Aden, Yemen from the previous October. And so we knew how to investigate terrorists. We had done it for years. We've done it for decades. Mm-hmm. And the federal court system in the United States, the Article III court of our Constitution, enabled us to prosecute terrorists in the past. But President Bush said that that those courts were not practicable. And by November 13, 2001, he issued a military order stating that he had, as president, had the authority to bring to justice before military commissions anyone who is or was a member of the Al-Qaeda terrorist network or knowingly aided, abetted, or harbored that terrorist network. And that order wound up on my lap to create a task force to conduct those investigations. And so as I look back now, 20 years later, it is unfortunately an opportunity lost.
There's been overwhelming evidence that many of the information gathered by the United States, even information that was supposed to provide the legitimacy for a war in Iraq, that Iraq had WMDs, came from confessions that were extracted via torture. No one has since been held accountable for that, whether a war in Iraq that killed hundreds of thousands of people or still people who have been victims of torture. Is this conversation still happening 20 years after, these policies to extract information were written?
Yeah, so this is the challenge we face now, particularly in Afghanistan, where we are now having to deal with Taliban leadership who have spent time at Guantanamo, who have been within dark prisons in the tribal, and the tribal leaders have been subjected to different variations of a family of interrogational abuses, and now they're in power in Afghanistan with the best weapons that U.S. money can buy, left behind by the Afghan forces that abandoned them. But this is the results of the U.S. losing our way. The decision to go to war in Iraq was based partially on an extracted information from Ibn Sheikh Alibi, the emir of Al-Qaeda training camp, who I was targeting to bring to justice for military commissions. He was, rather than using that process, he was ghosted to another country. He was brutally tortured. He said that there were high-level ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. President Bush went to Ohio to stir up the American public with that false and fabricated information. Colin Powell went before the United Nations and used that false information in misleading the coalition to go to war with Iraq. We invaded Iraq based partially on that information. And Ibn Sheikh Alibi later said that he just gave that information so that the pain would stop. People who are tortured or abused like that will say anything that their interrogators want them to hear. So people ask me, is torture effective? I ask them, is rape effective? Is genocide effective? The question is effective for what? Torture in that case was an effective policy decision. It was effective to support a policy decision with false and fabricated information. It is not a way to elicit accurate, reliable information. And there's an incredible effort underway right now globally called the Mendez Principles on effective interviewing with the co-chair of the former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. And I'm happy to tell you that one of your own, a South African native down there in Johannesburg, Sean Tate, who's the director of the African Police Civilian
He's a very good friend of the show as well.
Yeah, and he's on a 15-person steering committee that worked about 4 years putting together the Mendez Principles on Effective Interviewing to try to help reform the practice of policing so that we are not using abusive practice and we are using science. Because what we know from science is we know how to elicit reliable information from people in custody.
Marco, I want to bring into this conversation American journalist and war correspondent Bilal Abdul Karim, who has been covering what had been a consequence on the war in Iraq, the Syrian war, the emergence of ISIS coming out as a direct result on the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Bilal, thanks so much for joining us here on the Morning Review in Cape Town, South Africa. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about the far-reaching consequences, not just of 9/11, but an invasion of Afghanistan, a war in Iraq, essentially spreading across not only the Middle East, but also parts of Africa. The emergence of ISIS and other fundamentalist movements seen as a direct result on the U.S., the so-called U.S. war on terror.
Absolutely. Look, as long as you're going to approach these problems or issues of terrorism and such like that, and terrorism is real, as long as you're going to approach it from a standpoint of we are superior to you, therefore we have the right to do anything that we want, it's always going to breed more attacks. It will never be any different. There are so many armies. The American military thought they could do it in Afghanistan. The Russian military thought they could do it in Afghanistan. The American military thought they could do it in Vietnam. They thought that because they have superior firepower, superior number of troops, that they could go into countries and they can do anything that they want. And the outcome is going to be a favorable one. Well, history has taught us that this certainly isn't the case. It actually fans the flames. And it makes a bad situation significantly worse. And that's what we've seen in Iraq. This is what we've seen here in Syria. And who's accountable for it? Nobody. Nobody's accountable for it.
Bilal,
and I think that that's why. Yeah.
Bilal,
I'm sorry.
We've seen that the Presidential War Powers Act gave every president from George W. Bush all the way to Joe Biden specific far-reaching powers. The darling of liberalism, Barack Obama, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, is the president who has the notoriety of dropping the most, authorizing the most drone attacks of any U.S. president since 2001. What does this then say about the wide-reaching powers that American presidents had to affect almost every part of the world over the last 20 years?
Well, then you have to ask yourself a question. Did the Syrians vote for Barack Obama? No. Did the Afghans vote for Barack Obama? No. So then why is it that the powers that Congress or the U.S. Constitution gives to the American president, and I'm underlining the word American president here, and that gives them the authority to launch rockets and bombs into other countries? It's different if the Syrians and the Afghans could participate in U.S. elections, but they're not even asked about whether or not their drone attacks should be carried out in their countries and going after quote unquote terrorists or perceived terrorists. So once again, I have to say, if we're not going to approach this as a win-win situation, then certainly the situation will continue to get worse. There will be more unfinished and open-ended wars. It's not going to end. Mm. It's not going
to
end.
Mark, before I get back to you, I have one last question for Bilal before he has to leave us. You're an American citizen who has worked for many international news agencies. You've even worked for CNN as well. You've been covering war in Iraq and Syria. But you were also on a U.S. kill list, I understand. How did you find out about that, and how did you feel about being an American citizen, doing your job in those countries, but at the same time being monitored? I just want to go to Bilal and have him wrap up, then we'll come back to you. Bilal?
Got it.
I was the victim of a drone attack back in 2016. My car was hit with a missile, flew up in the air several times, landed on its side facing in the opposite direction. How I wasn't killed in that attack, I'm sure I have no idea. It just wasn't my time. Subsequently after that, I raised a case in court in Washington against the United States for that attack. Now, your question is, how did I end up on a list like that? Well, that's a question that I've been trying to put to the U.S. government for 5 years. And my position has been this. If you've got a problem with me or my activities or anything that you perceive that I'm doing, then that's what the courts are for. Let's sit down in court. You tell me what you thought it was that made me deserving to be on an assassination list. And then I could tell you, yeah, I did that. No, I didn't do that. And this is the proof for or against. Mm-hmm. But when you've got a situation where once again, they're just moving with impunity and arrogance, as your guest pointed out, as long as that's going to be the lens in which we are looking at things, I can never challenge anything in court. What's the point of having a court? My position has been clear. Let's go to court, charge me, give me the evidence that you believe makes me an undesirable, and then I'll have an opportunity to challenge it. But up until now, it's been a thing called state secrets, case dismissed. And that happened. We're in the appeal process right now, but I'm not gonna go away. I'm not going to just drop the case and just hope things work out for the best. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to fight the case and force them to either do one of two things. One, publicly admit that they made a mistake and that I'm not on any list. Or two, they're going to have to put something on the table in terms of evidence. And I'm going to keep fighting for my rights. I'm not going to go away.
Bilal Abdul Karim, American journalist who's based in Iraq, in Syria, has been covering the Syrian civil war there. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. Mark, just some of your responses to some of the comments made there by Bilal.
Well, I mean, certainly I can understand some of the things that he says, and is certainly concerned with. You know, the U.S. government has done everything that they can to hide, redact, or classify anything involving the torture program, and of course, anything they would do the same for anything involving the targeted killings using drones as a vehicle. But this is all part of the response. This fear-based response where they try to develop tactical solutions to strategic problems, right? You're not going to bomb your way out of a war. You can't shoot an ideology, right? You can't shoot a movement. You can shoot people. You can kill people. But that doesn't stop a movement. At the time of the September 11th attacks, Al-Qaeda had approximately 500 members. How many tens of thousands of violent extremists are out there now today? There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq until we created Iraq, when we invaded Iraq. The number one and two reasons that foreign fighters went into the battlefield in Iraq at the height of the deaths for U.S. and coalition forces was the driving reason that they went was Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, symbols of U.S. torture, subjugation, and oppression. And so that is the greatest threat to the United States post 9/11 was not a second wave of attacks. It was the manner in which we approached that first attack. We turned the global war on terrorism to a global war of terrorism. And we became the very creature that we feared, right? Some invading force that goes in, subjugates a population, and then wonders why they did not treat them as liberators. And we will live with that for decades because we have yet to hold anybody accountable.
When we talk about holding people accountable, we can talk about George W. Bush, Tony Blair. We can talk about leaders around the world, which George W. Bush said, you're either with us or you're against us. And it's a coalition of the willing. And of course, we can talk about the war hawks in Washington. 20 years on, do you see any form of direct censure against any leader as a result of the U.S.'s so-called war on terror?
Not as of now. I have not. There's been no accountability, and we really had an opportunity to do this when President Obama took office. He issued his executive order 13491 that says we won't torture and we need to find ways to better interview people who were threats for national security. And he said 492, he was going to close Guantanamo. But truly an opportunity lost because while Bush sanctioned torture, Obama gave it sanctuary in his policy of impunity, this look forward, not backwards approach. That, hey, that's just the past. Let's just move on. Well, you know who hasn't moved on? The families of the hundreds of thousands of people who died based on wars that were based on fabricated information. And so until we come to some reckoning as a country, until we admit to what we did, we committed war crimes. I mean, we committed war crimes in the name of the American people, and no one has been held accountable for that. Many of them have. George Tenet, the director of the CIA, was presented the Medal of Freedom for this. You had people issued tenure at law schools who were involved in the torture program. You had Gina Haspel, who became the director of the CIA, who by her own admissions in her hearings for confirmation at the Congress admitted to her involvement in the torture program. So until the U.S. comes to some type of reckoning, some type of truth commission, some type of public acknowledgement, a little more severe than just a flippant comment. Oh, we tortured some folks.
If war crimes were committed, do you believe that Americans should be hauled before the International Criminal Court at The Hague?
What what allows the International Criminal Court at The Hague to have jurisdiction over those crimes is the fact that the United States has not done anything to has not held anybody accountable. That it's the court of last resort. So the and they are looking at that. The U.S. Tried to issue sanctions against anyone who would dare investigate the U.S. for these war crimes in the past. So the U.S. can stop those right away. All they need to do is show that they will hold people who tortured accountable, as they were required to under the Convention Against Tortures and our treaty obligations. And that's what we have yet refused to do.
Mark Fallon, counterterrorism expert, is also author of a book called Unjustifiable Means.